Welcome to FemWonk, a podcast about politics, public policy, and current affairs that takes an intersectional approach to topics that we care about. I'm your host, Katie Davey. Thanks so much for joining me. We're back, and we've got some changes. We're going to be posting episodes on Thursdays now instead of Tuesdays. We're also not going to stick to a rigid weekly episode schedule. This podcast is a project that I love doing, but I do it in my spare time. I want to ensure that it continues to bring me joy, and stressing out about ensuring that there's a weekly episode does not bring me joy. So do subscribe wherever you are listening right now to ensure that you are notified when a new episode is available. You can head over to femwonk.com to join our mailing list as well. I do send out an email whenever a new episode is available. I hope you've all enjoyed some break time over the last few weeks, but we're just going to jump right back into it. So our last episode was released on November 24th, and it seems like everything happened in the, 6 weeks between that release date and this release date. So I thought it would be a great idea to invite back one of my personal favorite political commentators, if he'll allow me to call him that, Jordan O'Brien. You'll remember him from two other episodes. So you are now the most frequent guest of FemWonk. Congratulations.
That is a huge honor. Thank you.
So, like I said, so many things have happened since our last episode. That includes federal mandate letters, Andrew Scheer resigning, Blaine Higgs threatening a confidence vote in New Brunswick, the UK elections, Greta being named Person of the Year, Finland having now a prime minister who is a woman and under 35, with almost all of the major cabinet posts being held by women as well. Northwest Territories naming the first majority women cabinet in Canada. Yet another democratic debate. I mean, they happen once a month, so that's not really news. And then, of course, Iran. So we could literally spend an entire episode talking about any one of these particular topics. So I thought it would be kind of fun. I don't know if fun's the right word. I guess for us it is fun. But I thought it would be interesting, there's better, for us to dissect a little bit about why so many things happen at this particular time of year and dig in a little bit to some underlying themes. And then I'm going to take a note from my friends at Ontario Loud, which is another podcast that focuses on Ontario, and we're going to play a bit of a game. And I'm going to draw three topics out of a hat, three of the topics that I just named, actually. And we're going to talk for kind of 5 or so minutes about those specific topics. I thought that was kind of the fairest way to give attention to all of these many things that happen. So I don't know. Does that sound good to you?
Sounds like a plan.
I'm going to ask you first from a bit of more of a mechanics of government, as you know, you spent quite a bit of time on the political side. What makes so much happen in the fall, or why, I guess, does so much happen in that period, really, I would say, between like Thanksgiving and Christmas?
I think it's probably more psychological than anything, and it's probably subconsciously so, that you have two kind of natural slowdown periods in the year. The summer, many people are on vacation. Things just tend to move slower in the summer. You probably don't take on any kind of big outward-facing communications or stakeholder initiative in the summer because there's a perception, I don't know how real it is, particularly nowadays, but there's a perception that nobody's paying attention in the summer, people aren't going to be available. And then, of course, around the middle part of December to the 1st of January, you've got the Christmas holiday, a number of other holidays, because most of the whole Christmas thing has become such a secular holiday in the West, that everybody shuts down. So there's a stoppage. And I think in the summer, there's an inclination to say, let's just worry about that in the fall. And so things just get punted. Whereas in the Christmas, there's this psychological thing of a new year, a new agenda, new priorities. So everybody's like, oh my God, we're gonna get this done before Christmas because, you know, we don't want to push it into another year. So I think it's just that.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And I think also a lot of legislatures don't necessarily sit in the summer months. So they're preparing for the fall. and then just kind of go crazy on legislation and things like that in the legislature when they're actually sitting in the
floor. Yeah, that's definitely right. Mm-hmm.
So, okay, now a bit of a pivot. I highlighted a whole bunch of things that are kind of very interesting, but there's a lot going on in the world right now politically, and I would just love your opinion on, like, what the hell is going on right now in politics? Like, it feels like, and I don't know if this is the rise of social media or what, but it feels like there's something new every single day. And just, it's hard to keep up. It's hard to follow. It's hard to parse through what actually is a big deal and what isn't and what's going on.
Well, we've been in a period, I think, of fairly turbulent, unpredictable politics for a number of years now. I don't know when you want to put your finger on it starting, but Brexit, election of Trump, that sort of thing, maybe a little further back, the rise of the AfD, kind of right-wing xenophobic party in Germany in 2013. You know, there's lots of that sort of stuff that's been happening in the last less than 10 years. I don't know if what the causes of that. I mean, it's easy to blame social media, and I tend to, if I'm asked to give a simple explanation, blame social media. There used to be a necessity for people to have success in politics to appeal broadly. And so you, in places where there wasn't proportional representation, you generally had two parties, one slightly right of center, one slightly left of center. And even in places where you had proportional representation, there was still some pretty big anchor parties that between them would enjoy 70-80% of the popular vote, and then a lot of smaller parties. I blame social media for this idea that people, and there's good and bad to it, but people with what you might call non-mainstream views, and that's both of the left and the right, and of non-ideological things, like we could talk about vaccination, that sort of thing. These people, although I don't think they're any more numerous than they were before, they're now able to find each other in a way that they couldn't before. And so the result of that is they realize that they're more numerous than they are. So where in the past, if you had a point of view and none of your friends and family had that point of view, then maybe you felt you should be quiet about it. Now these people go onto social media and they find many other people with that point of view, and they all kind of fall into an echo chamber. They are no longer kind of compelled by the conventional wisdom to think that their views are non-mainstream and to change them. And so that's kind of what I think is the cause of that, but I don't really know.
The other piece to that too is, because there's more of an avenue to see what these extreme views are, like you said, one side or the other, they get a bit more attention, even in traditional mainstream media, because there is that tension or that hook in a way that might not have been seen before. Okay, we've primed what the heck is going on. Now we're going to get into the game. This is the first game of FemWonk ever as well, so lots of great milestones tonight. So I actually have all of the topics I mentioned earlier written on little pieces of paper beside me here. I'm just going to pick one, and then we're just going to have kind of, I don't know, 5 or so minute conversation about that topic, and then we'll move on to the next one. Sound good?
You don't have a hat?
Well, I don't actually wear a lot of hats, to be honest. I could find another vessel, I guess.
But... No, I'm sure we can trust you to have properly randomized them on your counter.
Oh, of course, the fun one. Andrew Scheer's resignation. Dun, dun, dun. just before Christmas, Andrew Scheer announced he would be resigning. There was lots of build up to this from kind of people speculating about if he should resign, if he shouldn't, talking about, you know, the leadership review, all those kind of things. But then he did end up resigning, and that coincided with I guess, a story coming out that the Conservative Party fund had been subsidizing his kids' private school tuition. Some speculate that is why he stepped down. Others think it's just a happy coincidence, but that I would say is kind of the lay of the land. Would you, anything to add?
I'm in the camp of those that think that the private school thing might have accelerated things, but I don't think it was necessarily decisive. I wrote about this a little bit myself, actually, and then the game of expectations in politics is very overwhelming, and I think that Andrew Scheer's career of late is a great example of that. When he became leader of the Conservative Party a couple of years ago, if you had suggested that the election was going to turn out the way that it did, the Conservatives would have been very enthusiastic, and Scheer would have quite easily fetted for his success and would still be leader right now. Unfortunately, expectations came up quite a lot higher the last, 6 months or 9 months leading into the election. Scheer facilitated some of that, predicting he was going to be prime minister, etc. There was that infamous moment in the debate where he and Elizabeth May get into an argument over whether or not he was going to be prime minister. And I think the problem is that, Andrew Scheer was never really the overwhelming choice of the membership of that party to be leader. He was a consensus candidate that beat Maxime Bernier 51-49 on I don't know which ballot, but after many ballots. And, he raised expectations to a level he couldn't meet. And I always felt from the get-go after Election Day, he would be very difficult for him to survive that leadership review that was scheduled for April. Tom Mulcair, who lost a leadership review in the recent past in this country, probably had a better shot of holding on than Andrew Scheer, and he didn't. So I would just think the writing was on the wall. And the timing was, if he didn't go by before the end of the year, it would have been very difficult for the party to cancel the planned leadership review in April. And then it just turns into a fiasco. So I always thought he'd go by Christmas. So I guess I'm just very prescient, except for when I'm wrong most of the time.
I think that's so interesting. I actually listened to the Hurley Burley podcast. I don't know if you listened to that. It's with David Hurley. Mm-hmm. And he had Hamish Marshall, is that on just actually, I think it was released on maybe the day after Christmas. Anyways, it was a fascinating interview because it was exactly what you just kind of said there, which was Hamish never really thought they had a chance of winning a majority. But what do you say to a base? What do you say publicly? Like, that's kind of what he was saying. And he was like, you can't walk into a meeting of members or even the board or whatever and say, hey, we're probably not going to pull it off, but we're going to get, a sizable number of seats. So like you just said, there was this false, it seems, expectation created, and then there was no way Scheer was going to meet it. So then when he didn't, it just, reiterated. They kind of put the nail in their own coffin in a way.
So, so the big question to me is what's next? So they've set their date, June 27th, which I was surprised at how quick it was.
Which is the same day as Toronto Pride.
I heard that, thanks to Michelle Rempel. she's kind of trolling her own party there. So I don't know if that was somebody oversighting something or what, but it'll be curious to see which sort of candidates run. Do we have a Michelle Rempel who's a bit of a difficult person to pin down in terms of what branch of the party she represents? She's very conservative on some issues and a bit adversarial and kind of get that typical Alberta Prairie conservative bent to her, except for on social policy. She's been very outspoken on issues of choice, on issues of sexual orientation and so forth. So I'd be very curious to see what kind of a campaign and what kind of a coalition of members she might be able to put together. Because on the one hand, she's probably the sort of leader that they need, in that the base would like her on most issues. But I think she would have a hard time winning the leadership because she's too right-wing for Eastern Canadians on some issues and too left-wing for Western Canadians on other issues. When I say Western Canadians, I should say Western and Eastern conservatives. So that's a very interesting. We have no idea if she's thinking of running. But just generally speaking, if you look at the list of plausible leadership candidates, there's a lot of talk in the media of Peter MacKay. But if you look within the caucus, even with the defeat of Lisa Raitt, it's mostly women. There's Candace Bergen, and there's Michelle Rempel, and there's a few others. So anyway, I think it's going to be an interesting 6 months.
Yeah, I actually literally just opened Twitter, and the top story on my feed is that Pierre Poilievre just announced that he's running, and John Baird will be his campaign chair. So nothing like breaking news.
There you go.
But yeah, I mean, one of the things that kind of struck me about the details, I guess, of the leadership was the fairly dramatic increase in the amount of money the candidates have to put up and the amount of members they have to put up. So it's 300,000 and 3,000 respectively, I think.
I think they're doing the right thing there. I don't know how many candidates there were in the last leadership race, but I think it was double digits.
Oh, yeah.
And like some of these people were 2-3% of the vote on the first ballot. And I don't necessarily think that that's in anybody's interest. I mean, in Britain, it's a bit different because they're very new to this membership-driven leadership races until the very recent past. It was still the caucus that was choosing the leaders. But in Britain, you need to have a significant percentage of the caucus to sign your papers in order to be a candidate. And you have to be a member of the caucus in order to be a candidate. And it makes it mathematically impossible for there to be more than a half dozen candidates for leader. And I think that that is a nice balance. I mean, we sometimes forget that in our system of government, it doesn't matter what a party membership says. At the end of the day, if a majority of MPs don't like a leader, they're the only ones that actually have a constitutional say in who the leader is, because if you don't have the confidence of the House, you're not going to serve any position of power. And I think that's a better balance, that because you get these weird situations where people win the leadership with little to no support from their caucus, and then they're immediately starting off from a very weak position. And the infighting begins and the leaks and so forth. And that British notion of caucus nominates and the leadership and the membership decides, I think is a better balance.
Yeah, I think that's fair. The only thing, I guess, my counter is, so the time frame of the leadership is quite short, right? That's six mm-hmm. months from now. And then those thresholds are much higher. So because of that, you are favoring, I guess, you know, caucus members, more well-known folks, people that have a bit of organization behind them, which, again, not necessarily a bad thing. That's what you have to do, you know, to win elections. But I think it does add that barrier to entry. But I think your points are well taken that, you know, that barrier to entry is maybe not necessarily a bad thing. Next topic. Okay. Da-da-da-da. Eyes are closed. Okay, so the Higgs and confidence is what is written on this piece of paper. I do not want this to be an entire podcast of white men, though, so we might have to
cross our fingers for the next one.
Yep. But this one I think is really fascinating, particularly for listeners who maybe aren't following New Brunswick politics that closely, which I would say is probably many of them, even those in New Brunswick. And to be honest with you, I haven't been following this issue that closely either. But basically, I guess the high level overview, as everybody knows, New Brunswick is in a minority situation, propped up by conservative government, propped up by the People's Alliance, and there has been this controversial bill, really for most of the Higgs mandate about.
It's an ongoing labor dispute with nursing home workers.
Yeah, I was like, how do I frame this and not have to give the 1 year context? Yeah, exactly. Nursing home workers labor dispute, and there was a bill in the House that would basically limit the collective bargaining ability to what the government or ability to pay is basically.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. What it's called. So government in any sort of dispute, they could kind of get out of anything with the ability to pay notion. So this was pretty contentious for many reasons. And at kind of the last minute, Higgs basically said he would make this a vote of confidence, meaning, again, for listeners who might not have been reading their constitution over the break, Higgs can say this is a vote of confidence. If it fails, his government falls. So not necessarily something that many folks want at the moment. So Jordan, I'm going to give you take it away with more context and or takes.
So I just want to pull her up to 20,000 feet for a second. And just as a New Brunswicker, I always like to give out a shout out for New Brunswick. New Brunswick's often been a microcosm. Well, it is a microcosm of Canada. We have a similar English-French breakdown. We have a similar percentage of the population is Indigenous. We have a rural and relatively urban split. So there's a lot of you know, opportunities to, if you will, trial, predict, look for Canadian context in New Brunswick. And there's been a lot of history for that. We had the Core Party, which is essentially the Reform Party, go from nothing to official opposition in 1991. The same thing happened federally in 1993. And there's a whole bunch of other examples I can get into like that. So what I think is kind of interesting about this is, aside from British Columbia, which is a bit of an outlier, and I'll get to that in a second, New Brunswick was the first of the jurisdictions to go to a minority, followed by PEI, then Newfoundland and Labrador, and now Canada. And what those four all have in common that's different from BC is they're minority governments with no formal agreement to hold power. It's a case-by-case thing, whereas in BC they have a confidence and supply agreement. And so when you get into those situations where it's a minority government, there are three types of confidence votes. There's an explicit confidence vote, and that's when the House votes on a motion that has the word confidence in it. So this House has no confidence in the government, for example. There's an implicit confidence vote, which is, it's been a well understood tradition in the Westminster system for a long, long time, that if you can't obtain supply, that is pass bills that allow you to spend money, then you can't have the confidence of the House. So supply matters are implicit motions of confidence. And then there's this third nebulous category, which is discretionary confidence votes. And it's also been a well-established tradition that because the Crown is only supposed to take advice from the First Minister, and the Crown is supposed to accept the advice from the First Minister in all instances, unless there's some extraordinary, unconstitutional, offside thing, it's really a matter for the First Minister, in this case the Premier, to determine whether or not he has the confidence of the House. And if he doesn't think he does, and he tells the Crown's representative that he does not, then he doesn't have it, because she's going to accept that, because who is she to reject his counsel? So we have this notion where a leader of a government at any time can say that any vote is a matter of confidence. And Stephen Harper used this to great effect when he was prime minister for the first 5 years of minority government, in that, you know, he governed by threat. His party was best prepared for an election. And so if he had something that he wanted to pass that wasn't quite, you know, aligned with a majority of members of parliament, he would just issue the threat, this will pass or there will be an election. And Higgs has done the same thing, and it seems to have worked for him. The People's Alliance, who has a very informal, non-written notional agreement to support him on confidence measures, fell into line and allowed him to have this legislation pass. Will we see that in any of these other jurisdictions? In PEI and Newfoundland, the numbers are so close to a majority for the governments, they probably won't face these challenges as often. But PEI in particular is playing a very warm and fuzzy consensus, we're all friends card. In Ottawa, it will be interesting. And it'll be very interesting because the NDP, contrary to my expectations, came out very, very quickly against the throne speech in December. But the Bloc then quickly came in behind them and said yes. Now, was that a deal that was done? Or was that people looking at it on its merits? I don't know the answer to that. But as time goes on, if one day Trudeau hasn't done his homework, or just simply will not concede his position on a certain issue and the other parties all say no, will he allow that item to be defeated and go on if it's not an explicit or implicit matter of confidence? Or will he issue the threat and will it be effective? It'll be curious to see.
Yeah, a lot in there. And I will just remind folks, I actually just looked it up, which is crazy for me to think of, but we did an episode together on the rise of minority governments in Canada on April 30th. That was so long ago.
Time flies.
Yeah, so that was episode 15, if people want to go back and listen to that and hear a bit more about it. Yeah, I think what you said is interesting, and a couple of things that really struck me. One, you know, Higgs is doing exactly what you predicted he would do when we were around the negotiating table a year ago in New Brunswick with the other parties, with the third parties. Literally, you were like, he will govern like Stephen Harper. Like, that is what will happen. And that, as soon as I saw that story, I immediately was like, Jordan has a crystal ball. Which is, yeah, kind of crazy. But I think that also shows that some parties, and like you just mentioned with the NDP, there are some parties that are going to take a pragmatic view and some that are going to take an ideological view, and that knowing and not knowing, I guess, when that's going to happen is really dangerous to a government mandate, or in a minority situation particularly. But that's just something that, yeah, I'm kind of struck by, is when you think somebody might act pragmatically and they act ideologically, all bets are off.
Yeah, it's very interesting to see. I mean, somebody somewhere needs to do some serious, maybe reporting, but maybe academic study on what's going on in PEI right now. It's really fascinating. They are governing in a way I've never seen in this country. All MLAs get the same briefings that ministers get on all matters that are coming forward. And it's just, it's really quite interesting to see how far back they've pulled the curtain. And how well it seems to be working for them. Will that pass the test of time? Would that practically work somewhere else? Would be questions I don't know the answer to, but certainly in a minority scenario, there's a lot of merit to that. It's the same as anything, you know, when in managing stakeholders, which these MPs or MLAs or MHAs or MNAs are all stakeholders, particularly when there's no cohesive block that holds the majority of seats. And the first rule in stakeholder management is no surprises, right?
Yeah.
And so governments have traditionally governed by surprise, right? We want to keep this a secret so we can get the best media coverage when it comes out. We want it to be newsworthy, etc. So that runs completely counter to good relationship management. So which wins, and what does that mean for the durability of these minority governments?
Yeah, and I think to that point too, you know, one of the first rules of stakeholder relations is build trust, right? From whatever side you're on, government or otherwise. And when you are in these minority situations, when they're kind of new, which again, I think we saw in New Brunswick, a brand new situation, you have parties, because of the way our system is set up, that spend all of their time fighting each other and then are asked to work with each other and or support a minority government. And that transition is very difficult when you have spent the better part of, you know, four more years arguing with each other. And like you just said, trying to keep things from each other and having these, you know, media stories and not wanting things to get out, or even, you know, getting intel from another party and using that to your advantage. It's very difficult to pivot into that working relationship. And I think, again, you are seeing this with the Higgs government. He's treating the People's Alliance very well and not treating the other parties very well at all. So,
well, he's been fairly transparent about that. I mean,
his
view is you dance with who rung you, and that's how he's operating. And I think that's a bit old fashioned, and it's serving him very well so far. But a day will come when a day could come when he might be able to find support from the Greens less likely the Liberals, but the Greens certainly on a particular issue. And he won't have built the trust to leverage that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think just to your point too about how this will play out federally, you know, you had Trudeau come out and say in his very first press conference, basically, that they're going to still do pipelines while also trying to do pharmacare. And so that's like looking at both sides of the coin. And so it'll be interesting to see, again, I guess when I talk about pragmatism versus ideology, how comfortable some parties are with like letting those other things go by. Like, are they going to support something that is beneficial to them if something else has gone forward that they disagree with? That's something that I'm really interested to see.
Yeah, and the one thing I would wonder is some people noticed that the word pipeline did not appear in the throne speech. And was that a conscious effort to give the bloc the cover they needed to vote for it? And that's throne speeches are always the hardest. And it's kind of funny because they're the least important. They're non-binding, but they also talk about everything. So it's very easy for everybody to find one thing they object to. So I was very intrigued by the notion of whether or not the omission of the word pipeline was by strategic design and perhaps even by preconceived consultation with the bloc.
Okay. Third topic. Ready?
Ready.
I feel like there should be music, but I do not have that. Okay. I picked Northwest Territories. So I think we probably have a bit less to say on this overall, but I think you've been a bit more abreast to what has been going on. But again, context, the premier of the Northwest Territories right now is the only woman first minister in Canada, and she has recently-ish appointed a cabinet of 7 people total, if I'm correct, and 4 are women.
Yeah, don't quote me on the numbers, but it is majority female.
Yeah, so that making it the first majority female cabinet in Canadian history, I think.
I think you're right, like, yeah.
We'll double check on that. So I guess, just your thoughts and reactions on this. Honestly, like, I've seen very little media coverage on this at all, which is unfortunate. But I think, again, like I mentioned, all these things happening kind of at once, it ended up being something that fell off the wagon.
Yeah, so it's a just for the benefit of those who aren't as huge of nerds as us, it's a very, very different system. In that there are no political parties, and the everybody's elected to the legislature as an independent, and they go through a very interesting process where they elect by secret ballot a premier, and they elect by secret ballot a cabinet, and the premier chooses the portfolios but not the members of the cabinet. So Premier Cochrane has these ministers that she didn't choose. She assigned portfolios to them after they were chosen for her by her fellow legislators. So they're kind of in a perpetual minority government, if you will, in that the cabinet is a minority of members, and the non-ministers all kind of form an unofficial opposition. But that's not how they roll. Like, it's very much it's called consensus government and operates that way. So the fact that it's majority female, I think, is all that more noteworthy and newsworthy, because that wasn't some premier who was trying to make a point. It was actually what the will of the legislators was. And so it's, if you count the premier, I looked it up here, it's 5 women and 2 men. So it's, you know, almost 2-1. Mm-hmm. It is 2-1. Yeah. It is 2-1. It's more than 2-1. So it's very interesting. I think it's very interesting because it was organic, as opposed to, Justin Trudeau's cabinet has gender parity because Justin Trudeau consciously wanted his cabinet to have gender parity and took steps to make it occur. And that's noteworthy for certain reasons, but the fact that this cabinet is 5-2 female because that's what legislators in the privacy of a secret ballot box wanted, I think is that much more noteworthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good point. And shows more than just a shift in the opinion of one person, but rather in the shift of, you know, not that many people. Yeah. but yeah, I mean, I think it is important because, again, like, they all those members have constituencies that they go back to. So to see, yeah, that will, I think, is really interesting and important. And yeah, hopefully we see some more coverage coming out of that. I think, though, interesting, and we already drew our three topics, but I do think two things that are kind of interesting about what we just talked about overall. When you look at Finland, it's kind of two of the things. So on the minority government side, and you talked about PEI, you know, in many of the European governments, it's a PR system, and it's like multiple parties are actually present in cabinet, kind of more of a consensus-based model, and the majority female cabinet in Northwest Territories. So I've just been fascinated about the recent elections in Finland, and then also, yeah, like, people learning a bit more about how their cabinet is made up, right? Like, yeah, there are women in all of the major portfolios, basically, or most of them. But those are not members of the prime minister's party. Those are actually members, leaders of other parties. And that's kind of how the model works. So I think that's just really interesting and something that we, as we head towards perhaps more of a minority, more normalcy around minority governments in Canada, it'd be interesting to see how that evolves.
Well, it'll be curious to see if and when we get a full-blown coalition government. I mean, there was one in Saskatchewan in 1999, and I think that that's maybe the only one in Canadian history. And it's just we don't – minority governments are not common, but they're not so unusual that people don't know how to wrap their heads around them. It's very difficult for people to wrap their heads around the notion of coalition government. And I think it's because we've consumed far too much American news, and we think we're voting for a prime minister when we're not. And we think we're voting for a prime minister's platform when we're not. And, you know, the notion of a coalition government is not only does the cabinet become multi-party, so does the government's agenda. So you don't actually see anybody's whole platform in a throne speech. You see bits and pieces of other people's platforms in a throne speech, and you see essentially a platform negotiated after the election that comes out, and it's usually in the form of a coalition agreement. And that is so novel to Canadians. And Stephen Harper in 2008 used that novelness to great effect in suggesting people were trying to steal an election when they wanted to form a coalition government that was supported by a majority of MPs, but didn't include the party that had won the most seats. And so if and when we will get over that hump and it will become, quote unquote, normal/acceptable, I don't know when or if that will happen, but it could be quite transformative if it does happen.
Yeah, well, like a perfect example, I mean, there are many other factors at play, but the third speech that we brought forward in New Brunswick, in November, was that November 2017?
2018.
What year are we? 2020. Yeah. that was exactly what we tried to do, and it was not well received, like I said.
Well, it was a shopping list is what it was described as.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was a pretty simple exercise, and I mean, you did most of the work with the support of some officials. I mean, we went through all the platforms and said, okay, where are there things that are supported by two or more parties? Which to me seemed pretty obvious, but to the news media and some of the opposition parties seemed, you know, somehow wrong, which yeah. I didn't get.
No, I totally agree. Okay, on to some predictions, because this is our first episode of 2020, and you have a crazy, weird memory for these things. You did a great blog post, by the way.
Thank you.
Top political stories just recently, so check it out.
nbpolitico.blogspot.com.
I love that you haven't bought the domain name.
Look, it's old. It needs some refreshing. There's only three posts in 2019, and that was the first year I posted since 2014. So maybe we will see that get ramped up a little bit more, and maybe I'll even chill out the few bucks for a domain.
So, okay, I want to know, from your perspective, what were the top stories of the decade? So, yeah, let's be a bit more reflective first. And I want a worldwide one, I want a Canada one, and then I want a New Brunswick one.
Worldwide, the easy answer is Trump, but I'm not going to use that. And the other U.S. one, and it's so easy to gravitate to the U.S. because, you know, world power, superpower, etc. But Obama's re-election was pretty historic as well. But I'm not going to use that either. Brexit is very interesting to me, and I rated that the number one story of 2019. But I think the more I like to choose unorthodox answers, and this didn't come off as a big story, but I think it's going to have a far, far more lasting impact. And maybe I'm cheating because it hasn't happened yet. But Angela Merkel, who's been Chancellor of Germany now for 15 years, which is mind-boggling, has become kind of the adult in the room of international politics for, I mean, at least since Obama left office, but if not much longer than that. And she's announced that she's not seeking another term in 2021. And I think that that is really going to destabilize the good function and order of the global political discourse. So is that cheating because she hasn't actually left yet?
Well, it's not clear to me if you're answering the top story of the decade by saying she's leaving in 2021.
Well, she announced it. She announced it like 2 years ago.
No, I think that's fair. And I think, yeah, you're right. Like, she has been such a huge figure of the last decade. There's no question. And I think not only will that be a destabilizing thing worldwide, but, you know, Germany has also taken such a key role in the EU overall. And
yeah. Well, Brexit. Even more so now with Brexit.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, you know, you just think of Greece and some of the other things. Like, Germany really took the parent in the room approach. And
I don't know how closely you follow it, but, like, just to speak to how much power and influence she has in the EU. So there's a relatively new informal process where the parties or the coalition of parties that run in European elections kind of nominate who they would put up to be president of the EU. And nobody won enough seats to kind of push through their person. So Merkel just kind of put up, like, one of her senior cabinet ministers says, this person's going to be president. And everybody said, okay. Like, it was just, like, not a big deal. Not even a member of the European Parliament, never really had any involvement in European politics before. She's just Merkel's most trusted cabinet minister, and now she's the president of the European Union because Angela Merkel said so.
I love that. That's amazing. Yeah, and, like, yeah, the EU is its own whole ballgame. That's incredibly difficult to understand, so it's a whole other thing. But, no, I like that. I think that is, yeah, an unorthodox choice, but a good one. Okay, Canada and New Brunswick.
Well, those are easy, I think. So, I mean, Trudeau is the story of the decade in Canada. He took the Liberal Party from third place to first, which everybody thought was impossible, including well into the writ in 2015, and won a pretty convincing majority, won an unprecedented number of seats in modern memory for the Liberals in Manitoba and Alberta, won every seat for the first time ever in Atlantic Canada. And then, although there's a lot of intervening things that occurred there where some might say he almost blew it, then kind of went into the 2019 election as, if not an underdog, certainly it was not viewed by people to be a slam dunk, and managed to win a lot of seats, 157, I think, is the final count. And I had talked to a friend of mine who's a reporter, and they did a pool of the newsroom, and the highest that anybody had the Liberals at was 144 out of, like, 40 journalists covering the federal election, and they get 157. So beat expectations in 2015, beat them again in 2019. I think that has to be the story. And then New Brunswick, again, fairly obvious. And I guess you can look at it from two different contexts, but the minority government that we have in New Brunswick, and or that being a subset of the story which is in September in 2010, for the first time in New Brunswick history, a first-term government was defeated. And then in September of 2014, that happened again. And then in September of 2018, that happened again. So that shift to one-term governments, and again, if I can use New Brunswick as a microcosm, the shift towards instability in politics, and then, of course, the outcome of that third one, which is this very unique minority scenario where you have a near equality of seats between the two biggest parties and an equality of seats between the two smaller parties that makes the mathematics so difficult. Like, I mean, if it weren't impossible just because of bad blood and personalities and egos, in any other jurisdiction in the world, there would have been a grand coalition, would have been the outcome of that election between the two biggest parties. And that wasn't even really discussed in New Brunswick because, I mean, the idea of the Liberals and the Conservatives forming a coalition together would be just viewed as absurd. But, I mean, that's what Germany has right now and had in the past as well, numerous times. But Merkel's had four terms and two were grand coalitions and two weren't. There were three grand coalitions. I think three were grand coalitions out of four. And that's a more normal thing in some countries when you can't quite get, when the big parties are so much bigger than the small parties that it's just logistically impossible to put together a coalition without the two big parties that are generally of the center and therefore ideologically not that far apart, but are arch nemesis. So it's hard to get past the personalities and the feelings.
Yeah, no, I think that is a great decade story because, yeah, it kicked off at the beginning and just kept going.
Kept going, and who knows? It seems I've always been a believer that this government in New Brunswick will be durable and we won't see another election until at least 2021, if not 2022. But the signs are starting to point more and more towards a 2020 election, so maybe we'll have another change of government four times in 10 years.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see what happens in the St. Croix by-election. Drama happening there. Well, that must be your biggest prediction for New Brunswick for 2020.
No, I actually still don't think there's going to be an election in 2020. Yeah. And so maybe that'll be my big prediction for New Brunswick. Although I'm less sure of that than I used to be, but I still don't think there'll be one.
Yeah. Okay. Biggest prediction for 2020. No boundaries.
This one, I'm sure, will be very popular with you personally, but I think Donald Trump will be reelected president of the United States.
If I didn't have the clean button clicked on my podcast overall, I would be saying many very aggressive things right now. But my clean rating, I don't like that very much. And you know why I don't like that very much? Is because
you predicted
in 2016 and I fought you every single day up until the last minute. I was in my Hillary for President t-shirt. We're watching the results and I'm like, it can't happen. It can't happen. It can't happen. And you're like, it's happening. It's happening.
Just because you don't want something to happen doesn't mean it won't happen.
I disagree. Have you ever heard of the law of attraction?
How about you? What's your big prediction there? Put you on the spot.
Well, okay, let me back up. This is a bit of a cop-out, to be honest, but I am reading for actually the first time, which I feel like I should get my like feminist wings clipped here, but reading The Handmaid's Tale for the first time right now. And it's excellent. But what is the most disheartening thing about it, to be honest, is like I'm reading it, and this book, you know, was published 25 years ago, and I'm reading it as if it was published yesterday. Like, so much of even just like, you know, there's these cameos of like protests and things like that. And I was reading just yesterday, and it was like, yeah, there were signs that say, like, my body, my choice. And I'm like, oh my God, this was not written 25 years ago. I refuse to believe that there has been so little progress in 25 years that, you know, we're still having these conversations. So that is like very disheartening for me. But I think like my 2020. I'm going with intentions. That's my thing this year, 2020 intentions. But in 2020, I just want there to be less siloing between gender and just more of like an explicit effort to do things in an intersectional way, which is not going to happen, but that is what I wish for the future.
I agree with you on both that not going to happen and being a good thing to wish for. If you look at our spheres that we just talked about, so in New Brunswick, you've got all four political parties led by men. You've got a government where we had a previous government where there were some women in some senior portfolios. There's no women really in senior portfolios. Nationally, Lisa Raitt was going to be the next leader of the Conservative Party. It was just a matter of time. Now she is no longer an MP and is not seeking the leadership. The one bright light, I guess, is that, you know, a Ronnie Ambrose or somebody like that could end up as opposition leader. And Chrystia Freeland is a dramatically powerful deputy prime minister, so that's interesting. But you look at the U.S., Elizabeth Warren is sliding out of the top tier. Bernie Sanders seems to have beaten her in the race for the left. And you look at the world, Theresa May was taken down. Angela Merkel's on her way out the door. Not to be depressing, but.
No, I know. And it's like, that is at, you know, the highest level, right? Like there are reasons why these things are happening, and like dissecting, even, you know, I'm doing my master's right now, and I like in my thesis proposal had to explicitly say that I would be performing a gender-based analysis on a policy. And I'm doing like quite an intersectional approach. I'm looking at a number of different identity factors, but like, why do I even have to say that? Like, why is it not just explicit that we will look at things from the perspective of how it will impact people broadly? Like, why is that just not a thing?
Someone says gender-based analysis, and many people hear women. They don't hear gender.
Yeah, or they, like, and you know, federally give them credit that they've added the plus, right? So it's not just, it's any identity factor, and that's, you know, what I'm taking in it too. But you're right, and people just immediately are like, well, obviously there's no gender impact to that. And when you peel back the layers, like CPP is such a prime example where when you just are like, oh yeah, the Canada pension plan or retirement or whatever, people are like, oh, of course, no gender lens. But that is one of the policies that actually has probably one of the most prominent gender lens to it, right? Because for a whole bunch of factors, you know, women live longer, they tend to have lower incomes overall throughout their life. Sometimes they tend to, you know, work fewer years, and all of these things compound. And anyways, so that is what I hope for the year. It's not a practical or tangible prediction, but
legit.
Yeah. I think my real prediction is that we're going to see ideology get in the way of pragmatism.
The world does seem to be becoming a far more ideological place. Although there was a win for non-ideology in Italy, not that we have time to go down that road, but generally speaking, it is becoming a far more ideological place. And the divergence between the centrist parties in different countries is a bit alarming.
No doubt there. I feel like this is a like sad way to end the episode, but it's supposed to be happy and prediction-y and intention and all of the fun words. That's okay. I think it's realistic, and that's probably a better place to be.
No, there you go.
Well, thank you, Jordan, for being a three-time FemWonk guest.
Thank you. I'm just like Israel. We can have three elections in a year. We can have three podcast appearances in a year. So thank you very much. It's fun, and Happy New Year.
Yes, Happy New Year to you.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, leave us a review. You can keep up with us on social media by following @FemWonk on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. See you next time.